let me have it try to make it work. Copy this.
And it's not just about why or how it becomes classical, but also what kind of classical system that it becomes in the limit. So if you have a theory of quantum gravity, you would like to know whether your classical limit is GR and not something else. So these are the problems that I wanted to address. And the theory which addresses those problems is the theory of decoherence. So that's what I will talk about. So first, let me introduce some concept that you may not be familiar with, which is, well, I'm sure you're familiar with the Heisenberg picture where observables evolve instead of states. Right? It takes a slightly different form in if you consider an open evolution, so a stochastic evolution. So that's the most general map of, that's the most general way to evolve a quantum state between two moments in time. It's a quantum channel. These are operators acting as density matrix. And if it's only one term, you get a unitary evolution. So that's what I will call a quantum channel. And that's a Heisenberg, the Schrödinger picture, because it evolves states. But what matters in physics are expectation values, where A is an observable. And so if I write an expectation values on the later state, and expand the channel and use the cyclicity of the trace and the linearity of the trace, then instead of transforming the state, I can transform the observable with something that looks a lot like the Schrödinger channel, except that the dagger went from the right to the left. And so this thing is a dual channel, and it represents the evolution, the stochastic evolution of the observables instead of the states. What's a bit strange in this view is that, okay, well, first of all, let me just say that whereas this channel is a completely positive map, which preserves a trace because it has to send a state to a state, this one is also completely positive, but it preserves the identity instead of the trace. Now, what's a bit strange with this is that if you compose the channel, so this circle is a position map. So we apply first E and then the channel F. And we look at this in the dual picture, then it's the same as applying F first and then E. So we apply the later channel first. This means that the dual channel maps somehow observables back in time. It maps observables of the future system into observables of the past system. So we take the dual map, we exchange the way that things evolve. So now, let me, well, I will have to work in infinite dimension. So it is a convention that we replace those daggers by stars, just notation. Because I want to talk about the classical limit of quantum system, it's good to have a framework which is more general than both quantum and classical. So a framework which allows to, in certain contexts, either to talk about quantum or classical. And such a framework exists, and framework consists of algebras. It unifies both quantum and classical descriptions. So it also means that it's a framework which is more general than both quantum and classical systems. So suppose we have a mathematical object, which is a system algebra A. How do we put a physical interpretation on it? So the idea is that the elements of the algebra, the meaningful ones physically, are those which are which have eigenvalues which are between 0 and 1. So self-adjoint operator with eigenvalues between 0 and 1. These are interpreted as propositions about the physical system that is being described by the algebra A. So propositions are just observables which have two states, yes, no observables, or two-level observables. They're also called effects in the theory of quantum measurements. So then a state is a way to associate the truth value to every observable. So it's a state of knowledge of the system, and we have a degree of confidence for every proposition, which is a number between 0 and 1, or probability.
but a quantum logic should be versus something that has I zero and one character. In other words, you're taking the position to be any positive operator.
Yeah, because I'm looking forward to it. Well, I will talk about QVMs. So, in any way, these are unsharp, but it includes. There is no reason for now to distinguish those which are sharp and those which are not. It includes all of them. So, one important, what's important with the structure of the algebra is the linear structure. The states are linear, which means that the probability of the sum of two propositions is the sum of the probabilities, which means that we can interpret this this sum as a logical OR between the propositions, even if they're not sharp. And the probability of the operator 1 is always 1. So the operator 1 represents the proposition, which is always true. So how do we get quantum theory back? We get it when the algebra is a set of bounded operators on a Hilbert space. Because we only interpret, we are only using operator between 0 and 1 for physical interpretation, it's fine that we have bounded operators because these are all bounded. And in that case, we're familiar with the states which are trace of the product of a density matrix with the operator. And the density matrix is an element of B of H2, but it has a trace. They don't all have traces. So these are the trace. The trace class operators and the positive elements of trace 1 represent states. And we have those special effects, which are the sharp effects, which are projectives. The classical version of quantum theory is probability theory. We get it when the algebra is a set of functions on a set omega. These are functions which are bounded, just like the operators are bounded. And a state is given by an integral. So if A is an element of the algebra, it's a function of x, A, integrated over omega, and mu x is what we represent the state, and it's just a probability distribution. So it's an element of L1. That is, it's just a function of omega, which is integrable. And we also have sharp observables. So a sharp observable here is also a projector, but in that case, it's a function, a characteristic function of a subset of omega. So that's a function which is 1 on omega and 0 everywhere else. So that's how we recover the familiar sharp classical proposition, which are just a subset of omega. Yeah, sorry. L1 is just fine. So, the states really are the positive elements in L1, which have integral 1. The same thing for the algebra. I'm not using the whole algebra, but just these elements. The algebra is convenient because it's a span of the element. So now suppose that we have a quantum system with a Hilbert space H, and we assume that it has a classical limit which is represented by a phase space omega. So what does this mean? What is the relationship between the quantum and the classical system? So these two algebras, which describe some, which are physical description of, descriptions for physical systems, in that case, are describing the same physical. It's just two different languages talking about the same system. And the quantum language is, the quantum theory is more fundamental. The quantum language is more rich. So there must be a dictionary which translates each classical proposition into a quantum proposition. And that's what defines the classical limit. So as a kinematical, I'm not talking about dynamics. What did I? Oh, I'm sorry. No, that's wrong. Yeah, I believe it's from me. Don't read the word. And it's important that it goes in that direction, not the other direction. So I call this map gamma star. And we want this map to preserve this interpretation of the sum as a logical OR between propositions. So we want it to be linear. And it has to be positive to send propositions to propositions. And we will also assume that it sends a proposition which is always true to the proposition which is always true. This means that, well, technically, we also assume that it's a continuous with respect to the weak topology that these guys. But
assumption that things that somehow are always
true. Yeah, I agree. That's not, we pull one not to make this assumption. But I didn't think about it, but it might be that if we make a weaker assumption, then we only ask it to go to a projector. Then we can always extend it by adding one minus projector to get back into this framework. But for now, I'll just carry on with this assumption, and we can discuss later. Yeah, I guess. Right? It's an interesting question. Thank you. Well, it could be that the well, it could be that the classical limit is valid only for certain states, in which case we don't have this. But I don't know. Yeah, let me check.
Before I go further, help me is words about what you mean when you say limit. And I hear people say, well, we're going to take the classical limit in the classical limit such and such, but you seem to be meaning it more rigorously.
Yeah, so we are assuming that we are in a context for some reason, perhaps you know, maybe there's some restriction in the system, maybe it's being constrained, or maybe we lack information about the system, or maybe the set of measurements we can do is restricted by some physical mechanism. And so I'm not going into any detail. I don't know how it happens, but it happens that effectively we have two effective descriptions of the same physical system. And if that's the case, because P of H is more detailed, is a more detailed description, it should be a way that each of the propositions that I can make about my effective classical system has there's a way to translate it in terms of the more fundamental language, of the more fundamental theory, which is to translate it, what it means as a proposition and the quantum system that it actually is, right? It is, we know it's a quantum system. So there has to be a quantum description.
The classical limit translates operators, gamma star translates operators on omega into operators on H, which is particular H, right? You see the classical limit of H. And so when you talk about a sequence of Hilbert spaces increasingly large, right? As we let the larger and larger Hilbert spaces. How do I?
Well, that's really the whole. That's the last one, that's the whole, that would be the fundamental description of your physical system. So that would include all the particles, and the 24 particles. That would be a very simple, very simplistic classical description in a context in which it's valid. I'm not thinking of the, this is a very broad, very general point of view, but I will go in more detail.
Yeah. Among your L's is it the bounded function? This gap.
Yeah. Well, that will enter into the map. I mean, if something is not possible in the quantum framework, then you won't be able to write a map. It will, I mean, the target of the map is this valid quantum state. So nothing can go wrong. Well, I'll give you an example of actually a metaphor space. So maybe it will be more clear when you get there.
Okay. I mean, at the moment, there's no restriction that says every time you get a model, it's algebra for a space. There's nothing telling you what the image of this thing is. The image of this thing is.
Yeah, it could be that everything is mapped to the event. It could be that it's completely trivial.
Not necessarily the mathematical.
Let me. I will look at this in two different ways. So maybe another way would be more clear. So let me choose a second way in which to look at it. I put a star here because this map observables into observables. It's a Heisenberg. You can view it as a channel in the Heisenberg picture, and it is indeed dual to a channel in the Schrödinger picture. So now that's a channel which maps classical quantum state into classical state. So it goes in the other direction, and we can use one or the other. They are the same thing. There's different ways to look at it. Either you map classical observables to quantum observables, or map quantum state to classical state. And so this thing is a transfer, a channel, so it's transfer information from the quantum system to the classical. That's another way to look at it. All right. So there's a third way to look at this. This map gamma is a POV. It is a generalized observable. So why is that? Because it maps any classical proposition into a quantum one, and in particular, it maps any sharp classical proposition into a quantum one. And so to a subset of omega is associated a characteristic function, which is mapped by this map gamma star to a proposition of the quantum system. And that's exactly what POVM does. In fact, it has all the properties that is required of POVM. And in fact, the converse is true. If you have any POVM, then you can write it as a map of this sort. If you have POVM E, which associates a subset omega to an operator E of omega, it maps this state rho into a classical probability distribution, probability measure, which is given by just the expression values of the effect of the POVM. So a POVM is just a map, a channel from a quantum to a classical. It's a characteristic function of the subset omega. So it's a function which is one on omega, little omega, and zero. It's a sharp classical proposition. So maybe to give an example which is people are more familiar with in the context of quantum information, usually we work with a discrete POVM. So a discrete POVM is one in which a set of value big omega is discrete. So if that's the case, then because this map is linear, we can write any of these guys as a sum of elementary operators, which are those acting on a classic function of a set which contains only one element of the set omega, that is singletons. And we call them, I will call them just gamma k. They are the familiar POVM element. All right. So let me just summarize this. So a classical limit is, argues that the classical limit is specified by a channel from the quantum system to the effective classical pairing. And this is also precisely what an observable is, because where omega is then the state of the pointer of the measurement apparatus, which will serve in measuring that system. Because an observable is just precisely this kind of map. It's something which makes a relationship between properties of the classical measurement apparatus to the underlying properties of the underlying quantum system that is being measured. And so I would call gamma as a pointer observable if it actually defines a classical limit. So it is a generalization of the notion of pointer basis and super selection rules and so on in the case of decoherence. So let me give you examples. So the familiar point of view on decoherence where with a map, an evolution, a quantum evolution, which take any density matrix into one which is diagonal in a particular fixed basis. So in this case, the target here, if you vary all those diagonal elements, this is a commutative algebra, which is just L1 of 1, 2, 3, viewed as a subalgebra of those 3 by 3 density matrices. So this is a map between a quantum system, from a quantum system to a cluster. In that case, this map is an observable, the observable which maps quantum states to the classical probability distribution of the three states, which is given, where the probabilities are given by those three diagonal elements. And this observable, of course, is the sharp observables, which has three eigenvalues, and whose eigenvalues are the basis in which those matrices are diagonal. That's a very triggered example, which I'm trying to generalize. A less triggered example, and a very interesting one, is the case of a particle which is localized in a quantum particle, which is localized in space. So usually we think of it as seeing as the classical states as being coherent states in the quantum space. So in our framework, this means that in this case, there's a map gamma, which defines the classical limit. And that's a map which sends any state rho of the quantum particle to the probability distribution in space given by expected values with the coherent state. So that's how it maps state into state. The dual which maps classical observables to just functions into quantum effects is has this form. What's good about using POVMs is that we can have, this is a very idealized thing, because if we are actually localizing a quantum particle, it's unlikely that it happens to be exactly in one pure coherent state. So in general, we might expect to have a POVM which doesn't give you those exact pure states, but instead some positive orbitals which are coarse graining, so average of those pure coherent states. So here I just wrote a Gaussian averaging, a Gaussian coarse graining of these pure coherent states. So that would be a more realistic classical limit for particle localized in space. So maybe this. So if you put F be the identity function on the whole phase space, you will get the identity. Maybe I've got the measure wrong. So let's say we put the right measure. It is a perfect fit, but it is normalized. It does as if it's one. We put the right measure.
See, two
are not orthogonal. No, it's true. But if you put one here, this integral gives you one. That's it is a resolution.
So far, right?
By four.
I thought that's a. But I may be wrong on this.
Did
that last line,
have you
seen
me? Oh, I don't know what you see.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, no, I'll give you a way to to describe mathematically what a classical loop would be, and a way which is very general and much more general than what is usually being used in the case of difference. But now I want to give you a way to how this can actually emerge in the actual quantum evolution. So upon this, I need to introduce a concept of preserved observed order. But first, since I'm interested, since I'm describing observables in different ways than just operators, I have to repeat how the epoch has been structured because I will make use of this. So if we are given a quantum channel from between system A and B, and an observable now is a map from the observable on B, it's a map from the mixed state of B into the state. And so we can naturally compose them. We can apply first E from A to B, and then Y from the quantum system B to a classical measurement apparatus or something. And this defines a new observable, which is a map from A to the classical pointer state. So again, it evolves backward because, so that's how Y evolves into X in the hyperbaric picture. Again, it's backward because we are sending an observable of E into an observable of A. And it's quite a natural way to do it because we first apply the channel and then we measure Y. And that tells you what it is to measure X. If you get into the detail and look at what happens when we are actually looking at the effects that we get by applying Y star onto classical effects. So that's a quantum effect. And the dual channel maps the quantum effects of Y into the quantum effects of X. I'm just trying to make you familiar with this position, which is a bit unusual. It's more usual in the case where the observable is discrete. So the dual map QM elements of Y into QM elements of X. So now, if I have a channel, quantum channel E, then what I need is a way to recognize when it is decurrent, when it's actually destroying all the information but that which is represented by a single observable gamma. So in order to do this, I introduce a notion of observables which are preserved by the quantum channel. So I will say, so I have my quantum channel from A to B, and I have two observables here, X and Y. And I would say that X is preserved by E if, instead of directly measuring X on A, I could have just waited for the noise to operate and then measure Y on the result. This means that X has been preserved because I can recover all the information about X on if I'm just measuring something on the state of the final system after the channel has acted. It means the channel has not destroyed the information which is represented by X. So to read this diagram, it just means this path is equal to this path. So now if you look at things in terms of the Heisenberg picture, what it means is that an observable is preserved means that it is in the image of the Heisenberg evolution. If they exist Y, such that X equals Y composed with E. Okay. So now I want to define the, I want to associate with the channel the set of all preserved observables. So I call it P of E, the preserved observable for E. It is a set of channels, a set of observables on the initial system, which are image of some observable through the Heisenberg evolution. So just because this set is very big, maybe I will not say that. It's not very important. So let me give you an example. Suppose you have this this channel in a sort of continuous chaos form with these chaos operators, where picture G as some kind of Gaussian centered on zero. So what is this channel? This channel is what happened to the state rho if you do a bad measurement of position. So here I'm in the context of a single particle Schrödinger type, where those guys are just eigenstate of the position. So this channel is what happens to the state if you are measuring this QVM. So it's here expressed again as a channel which maps state into the classical probability distribution of position, which is a Gaussian averaging of the actual probability distribution you would get if you made a precise measurement of position. So this channel is what happens to the system if you do an inaccurate measurement of position. And you can show that this channel preserves an inaccurate measurement, of momentum, where G tilde is the Fourier transform of G. So it's a nice kind of way to express the uncertainty relation. It's saying that an inaccurate measurement of position preserves an inaccurate measurement of momentum. And the relationship between the inaccuracy of both is satisfies the Heisenberg relation, because it's the Fourier transform of this. So that's just an example of how we can use this concept. Let me give another example. So I've been looking at quantum observables, but you can also look at classical observables, which I just map between a classical system and maybe another classical system. These are also stochastic maps, which transform classical probability distributions. So I will say that an observable X is a coarse graining of another observable gamma if X is given by first measuring gamma and then applying this stochastic map, which just amounts to forgetting about something or shuffling information around. So the idea is that X contains less information than gamma, because to do X, I just measure gamma and then forget about something. Now, this diagram is exactly the same one as the one I used to define preserved information, except that here I had a quantum system instead of a classical one. But this is also a channel. So the set of coarse grainings in that sense of gamma is a set of observables which are preserved by gamma, just the same way that I defined preserved observables. So now you view this as a channel. And the set of X which are coarse graining, this for which phi exists, is a set of preserved observables by gamma. So this set is interesting. First of all, we are trying to explain when is some observable gamma preserved by channel E. But if gamma is preserved, then any coarse graining of gamma is also preserved. So we won't be able to talk about a channel which only preserves gamma, but we'll have to talk about a channel which preserves gamma, only gamma, and all its coarse graining. And I want to call such a set of observables, which are all coarse graining of gamma, a classical set. Because, first of all sharp observables in S commute with each other. And there's an unsharp generalization of this. So unsharp observable in unsharp propositions, or unsharp observables in S may not commute, but they are functionally coexistent for those who knows what that is. And another way to look at it is that gamma provides a non-contextual hidden variable model for S, because it converts any state, any quantum state, into a classical state for gamma. And it converts any observable in that set into, we can associate it with a classical observable phi of X, which are linked to this relationship, but just what it means for S to be inside this set of preserved of coarse graining. And then any probability you will get with the quantum state rho and the quantum observable X can be given in terms of those classical probability and classical observable. So now I can know those two elements, and I can ask, I can say that a channel is a fully decurrent if its set of preserved observables is classical, meaning that all the preserved observables by all the observables preserved by E are coarse graining of some QVM gap. So in a diagram, this is what you mean. I had two triangles, and now I just put the triangles together. So I have a channel from A to B, and I have a particular observable gamma, and I'm saying that all the observable X which are preserved for E, which means that Y exists, can also be simulated by first measuring gamma and then forgetting about something. So an example, so again, the good old example of decurrence. So that's a channel. The dual channel has this form where these states are the states in which those matrices are diagonal. And in that case, if an observable is, so what is a set of observables which are preserved by this channel? So if an observable X is preserved by E, then it means, okay, let me use just discrete observables because it's a bit simpler notation. So if I have a discrete observable X which is preserved by E, it means that there exists a QVM Y with element YK, where such XK is the image of YK under the dual channel. So if I expand it, I get this, and that phi KR is just a stochastic map matrix. What this means is that X is automatically a coarse graining of the pointer observable corresponding here written in the Heisenberg picture, but this observable is just the sharp observables which has eigenstates, which are the eigenstates in which these matrices are diagonal, as you would expect. And so in this case, we have that the set of preserved observables is exactly equal to the set of coarse grainings of that sharp observable. Now we can easily generalize this picture to a much more general observable if we just look at a channel of this form. So now those set of states, these are states which are not orthogonal. So that's a channel. And we can show in the same way that in the previous slide that for a channel like this, that such a channel is fully decurrent. The set of preserved observable is always always all coarse graining of that observable, of the discrete QVM with elements which are proportional to these non-orthogonal states. So this is a pretty general example of decurrence in terms of an unsharp pointer observable. But I have to mention that gamma itself is not preserved. That's why this is only included. But what is preserved here is, well, gamma is preserved if it's sharp, but if it's not sharp, it's not preserved. What is preserved is some kind of coarse grained version of gamma, which has elements which are of this form. So you see that if psi I and psi j are orthogonal, then gamma tilde is just gamma. But if it's not, then there's some spreading of the PUM elements. So this one is preserved by the channel. This example is important because it holds for the case, the interesting case of current state. So if we have this channel, which is actually what happens to the state if you measure the current state PUVM, that is of this form if you generalize this to an integral. And we actually have the same properties that it is entirely decurrent, and it is decurrent in terms of an unsharp pointer observable, which is the current state UVM. So that's a channel which describes an emergence to decurrence of a phase space. I want to make a remark about this notion of preserved observables, so which is that it an observable might be preserved and not being and not be reversible in the sense that it's not correctable. So what does it need for an observable to be correctable? So suppose that X is preserved, then it is correctable if you can invert its relation. What this means is that if we apply E first and then the correction channel R and then measure X, it's just like if we had measured X without doing anything. So X is exactly conserved by this map. So if this is possible, then we see that X is correctable, but not all preserved observables are corrected. In fact, there are various groups of preserved observables which are simultaneously corrected. By simultaneously, I mean through the same correction channel. In particular, all sharp preserved observables are correctable at the same time with the same correction channel. And more generally, for every code, P, so P is a projector on some subspace of the Hilbert space. For any code, there is some group of simultaneously correctable observable, which may not be a sharp.
I have multiple codes that get mapped. For instance, I have a channel that takes several subspaces, maps all the same output space. Then I can only choose one of those codes correct, right? I can't expand, I can't correct all of them at once. So I have sharp observables on each code space, not all simultaneously into sets that are simultaneously correctable, right?
Maybe I think the fact that you can correct subspaces which are, well, I don't know, I'm sure you wanted to, but maybe those subspaces are just orthogonal and you can correct them at the same time, but you can't correct superposition. That's the case where you correct hybrid algebra. So it is, this statement is true. But this is correction without the code. So it's something a bit special. It's something unusual if you look at the Schrödinger picture. That's a case where you don't do any encoding. You just correct afterward, and you can recover all the sharp preserved observables at once. And there's only one group. To get more groups in the code, you need to make sure that your initial state is inside the second code. So this can be on here. So now let me get a bit. Now what I've been talking about is only we have a channel from a system to itself at a later time, and I looked at what kind of information this channel preserves. But this is only half the story, because the reason why this channel is decurrent is because it is interacting with an environment. So we can purify it. It means that we can view this as interacting with some kind of, with other degrees of freedom, which will be the environment. And we trace out, we assume some initial state of the environment. We let them interact and trace out the environment. That's where the channel arrives. And instead of tracing out the environment, we could have traced out the system to get a channel from the system to the environment. This is called the complementary channel. It is unique. If E is given, this one is unique up to a unitary of the environment. And this channel describes, whereas this one describes what kind of information is preserved in the system, this one defines what information is flowing into the environment. And that's the other half of the picture. The reason why you may want to look at it is that the information preserved by the complementary channel is that which an observer has access to. This could be interpreted in two ways. One way is that it may be an observer who has access only to the environment, or you could say that the observer himself is part of the environment, therefore he only has access to the information which is preserved by the complementary channel, the information which is flowing into the environment. And What's more interesting is the information which is preserved by both channels. And we can take the intersection. So that's the information which is preserved in the system and which is flowing into the environment. And this information is good because, so I will call it I. So it's again a set of observables. So I can take the intersection because they are all observables on the initial system. So these are observables which, so this information is information that an observer will learn about and which can be used to make predictions because it is pertinent to the future state of the system. It represents some information which has been preserved in the system. So we can say several things about this set, in particular all sharp observers in this set commute with each other. Now the question is to know whether, in fact, they are classical in this more general sense that this set is, that these observers are all coarse graining of some UVM. I do not know the answer of this question. But I can give you an example. So look at the previous interesting example of a channel of this form, where this set again are not orthogonal, are not orthogonal. In that case, it's easy to show that the set of preserved observables is included in the set of observables which flow into the environment. And so in this case, so we see the channel is fully decurrent. So in that case, this set set of preserved observables are all coarse graining of gamma. And in that case, the environment learns everything about these observables. So it's really a good example of decurrent. Since I cannot conclude about this, I will make stronger assumptions. And I can because Olivier and others have observed that classical information is always found redundantly into the environment. So what I want to do is to consider a channel not from one to two, but from one to an arbitrary number. So you could view this as a various subsystem of the environment. And what I will ask is I will try to look at the information which, so first of all, if I trace out, if I take this big channel from one system to many subsystems of the environment, and I trace out by the case subsystem of the environment, then I get the channel EK from, EK goes from A to BK. And then I can look at this set, which is a set of observables which are preserved by all those channels at the same time. So these are observables of A, which I can measure indirectly through any of the subsystems of the environment. So this is something very familiar. I mean, it's true that if you have a big system, then if you're trying to measure the position at the center of mass, a big system, then the position is contained. The information about the position is contained in every single particle of the system. So it's not an unrealistic assumption. And so I want to show that this information is classical. So to do this, I want to build an observable of which they are all coarse graining. So what I do is I consider a set of observable xi, which is dense in this set. And because they are in this set, because they are in each of these guys, there exists yk's such that xk is the image of yk for the partial channel ek. And so I define this PUVM gamma, which is the following. I first set e act, and then I measure at the same time all the yk. I can measure them at the same time because they are on different systems. And then it's easy to see that xk is the coarse graining of gamma. Because to get xk, I just forget about the outcome of one of these observables that I measured in parallel. So in that case, this set is classical. I just have to close it because I don't know if this set is closed mathematically, but it doesn't make a big difference physically. So if we look at a set of observers which are broadcast into many parts of the environment, then this is always a classical set.
Trying to understand what's confusing me a little, or as I scratch my head. The intersection of single system operators, or single system observables.
So these observables are observables of A, remember?
Right. So these are observables. Gamma.
That's a blur.
Verbal. As E is
the. If E is the. E2. So that's the
okay.
So everything is always on A. This has to do with the fact that the Schrödinger picture maps everything back to A. And that's why I can make this intersection. So that's really the advantage of using the Hadamard picture instead of the Schrödinger picture, is that I can really talk about properties of A.
Yeah. Only million.
Yeah. Well, it's clear why. I'm doing this only for this. So I prove. Suppose I have n of n, then I could prove that any set of n obstacles are all classical. That would go for some gamma. But I might have a different gamma for every set. But if I let this go to infinity, then I can have an infinite set. And because I set up my Matzenkat formula to make sure that I is separable, then I can have enough of this. And fill almost the whole thing with them. But it's a very strong assumption, and it might actually be true for just two of them. I just don't know how to do it. So it's not too strong an assumption, because for any gamma, for any QVM, I can find some channel of this form which will broadcast from the whole information about them, which is actually pretty trivial, because I can just I can take just a channel to be gamma itself. If I want, I can always view this capital system as part of the quantum system. And because that's classical, I can copy it as many times as I want. And so I can just measure gamma and then copy the classical with it. And I can view this as a quantum channel, which from one system to many systems. And this is duplicating the information, all the information about this.
As system to larger systems, there are things that you can broadcast to two or to three systems that cannot be broadcast. Many systems.
You mean broadcast of cloning?
Pardon me?
Well, you mean
so cloning is a special case of broadcasting through states, right?
You mean classical?
Okay. There are the optimal broadcasting for one to two is a little bit broader than the optimal broadcasting for one to infinity. I'm just wondering if that would seem to imply that in fact this wouldn't say just two copy broadcasts.
Well,
if there's a
what you're referring to isn't approximate, but approximate cloning.
Certainly not.
Because it is the exact same way. So it might be that in this framework, cloning twice. If you can clone twice, and if you don't, it's number of times. I mean, you are right. If you look at approximate broadcasting, you can do. If you restrict the number of clones, you can do better. But it's a framework which is more restricted. This is some sort of. It's exact because I'm exactly preserving the PVM, but it's not exact because they have PVM, so it's PVM sharp. So it's a bit in between. Yeah. So everything is exact. No, the state itself is not exactly preserved, whatever way you would define. Well, you can define it in the way that Rubin and others have defined it, a notion of preserved state. But in that case, this notion of preserved state corresponds here to the notion of preserved sharp observer. So this is more general. So in that sense, it does correspond to some states which are only approximately preserved, even if the observers themselves are exactly. So this process here is just a schematic description of what you will get if you have a classical signal amplification in a measurement. I want to mention something, which is that in the articles of Olivier and others, they did not study the whole process by which information is being broadcast, but they look at just one moment in time and look at correlations in it, look at redundant correlations at that moment in time. So is this related to my framework? It is, as you might expect. You might expect that if X is preserved by both the channel and its complementary channel, so if that's the case, then there exists Y and Y prime, which means that mirroring Y on system I, I forgot to change my slide. I mean E and E complementary here. There could be also EI or EJ where there are different partial channels in the previous example. The point is that there are two different systems where I can measure X indirectly by measuring Y and system I or Y prime and J. That's what it means for X to be preserved by those channels. And so is that the case because both Y and Y prime carry information about the same observable, we intuitively expect that they are correlated. But this is something that has to be proven. And they are indeed correlated. So they won't be exactly correlated if X is unsharp. But let me just give you the case where X, where they are actually exactly correlated is when X is either sharp or more generally, if the PUVM elements are proportional to projectors, then if that's the case, we can prove that we have this relation, which means that Y and Y prime are exactly correlated. I don't know why there is. So these are the PUVM elements. These are the PUVM elements, Y and Y prime. And so this is this is the observables which correspond to measuring Y and Y prime at the same time. And this is the image under the Heisenberg evolution. And so this being zero whenever I is different from J means that there's probability zero to find two different answers when you measure them at the same time, so they are exactly correlated. So let me summarize this. In this talk, I've mentioned two points of view on the image of classicality to recurrence. There's one point of view in which somehow nature conspires to make the set of observables preserved by E classical. As a case where we have fully decurrent channels. But there may be a weaker notion of decurrence where we say that we only perceive that which is redundant. And I showed that this is always classical. So in this case, we don't need any conspiracy. It's automatic. If anything is redundant, then it would be automatically done. And if the redundant information actually comes from a system, so if this is done through a process and not just at one moment in time, if this information actually comes all from the initial system A, then this process constitutes a measurement. And so, of some observable gamma. And so, if that happens, then the state of the system is affected in consequence as it is affected in any quantum measurement, which gives you the active part of difference. So in my introduction, I say difference is about that quantum system look classical and behave classically. So this is saying we define classicality as things that look classical. And this implies that it actually makes things behave classically, at least these degrees of freedom which are being observed. And one consequence of this view might be that it might be that the decurrence is not ubiquitous. There's a lot of currents down there, but we only see that which is decurrent. So we just end on this, and we can all those results are in this archive paper. Thank you.
further questions?
And it's just one gamma is collided. So, it is the case of
gamma should be. I was wondering about that. Channel.
Oh, for the channel, that's key. Yeah, it's an important question. The way to go, because we need ways to characterize. That might be one way to find actual examples, well, to compute what channel is being, what is effective unshadowed, so that it emerges from the interaction to look at symmetries and by covariance. So anytime there is a covariance, we get a part of this information, this effective unshadowed. And that's how we get the case of coherence.
Just a very small question. On your conclusions, you say consequence decoherence is not ubiquitous. Is it fair to restate that as decoherence is not necessarily ubiquitous?
Yes.
No, important distinction. I just wanted to make sure that wasn't.
You're right.
There's no more questions on this next period.